session number 10767, room 16.
Mr. Joe Fitzpatrick, room 16. That was the job, that was the only job that you had to do.
That was the only work the NCOs, corporal upwards, under officers. That was the only job that we ever did. We didn't call upon to do anything else. You had to amuse yourself in your own way, pass the time away.
Some other prisoners would help in the administration of the camp, you said earlier.
Oh, well, what? I mean to say, there was two Belgians that had a bunk at the end of our hut, and one of them, Alfred van der Wiel, from Brussels, I do believe he was captured. He was in the war office, I think, in Belgium, and his friend, and a very, very intelligent fellow was this, Alfred van der Wiel. I've corresponded with him a little after the war, but of course that faded away. And he sent a photograph of the football team to Brussels, some friends, and they all he'd marked the line, and they'd ask all questions about me and whatnot. He said, "Oh, they take the fancy to you, my people in Brussels," but he wanted to improve his English. And as regards his writing, and also Joseph Brassier's writing, was copperplate writing. Beautiful. And I used to go of an evening. Will you come tonight, Joe? I said, yes, I wouldn't have to look at the papers. Well, he'd been doing a bit of homework, and he had a Cambridge and Oxford and an Oxford dictionary, and I would do a bit of parsing and analysing with him and showing him exactly what meant what and what was so-and-so, you see. And he was still to bits. And I used to do that very, very often. And he could speak English as good as I could eventually.
And what were their jobs in the camp?
Well, in the camp, they worked in the office. You know, in the office there.
What office is this?
Well, the commandant of the camp, and that is the head lad, and he was a gentleman, as far as I know of him, and they had a lot of work to do on behalf of the Belgians, you see. Entry in and coming in and changing camps and all that sort of business, on behalf of the Belgians.
Would there be British people doing the same as that for the British?
Oh, yes.
Did you ever meet them?
Not particularly, we didn't meet them. But I had to go to before the commandant once, and I think he was checking up because I'd done one or two little episodes, you see. And a funny thing, if you ever got caught, they never asked you your damn name.
Okay, well, I think probably the best thing to do, is for you to tell us those episodes before I put you off with my thing. What were these little episodes?
You're putting me. That very tall Belgian that said was a millionaire. One night they said they were going to go to a place about 5 miles. Am I on? 5 miles away. And there was me and him went out to the camp, and when we got down the road to cut through the woods, he put on a peak hat, and he had leggings on, and he had a big Macintosh. Well, he just looked like a Jerry officer. And I'm toddling with him, and got this railway line, and we walked along there for a mile or two, and there was a small house there, and they had beer on and everything, and so we were on the beer and having a little convivial, and then we'd go back again and going in the camp. Well, of course, he changed his hat back again to his ordinary Belgium hat, and just say good night to the guard, good night, good slaven, and go back in the camp.
You'd use forged passes to get out, had you?
Another time, not really. We did have them. We'd had them. For instance, one Belgian, on my photograph, he asked me for a 2-franc piece, and which was a bit of silver then, and he brushed it clean, and he did it by hand with a needle. And he did a picture of me on that coin. Marvellous. And you could tell it, you know. It was engraved on, you see.
How had you got out that night you went for a drink?
Wait a minute. But unfortunately, soon after I got back to England, some kind person pinched it. I hope it did him a bit of good. But anyway...
How had you got out that night, then, without a pass?
Well, the thing was going to the laundry. Well, that's a lot of cut across.
Yeah. So what was the second...
You see, I don't know whether he would be any different if he was winning the war or not. And that he would, but when your belly aches, you know, you'll do anything, won't you? I mean, see, if you're starving, and that's what they were doing. They were in a pretty bad way during that period after Carter made his push. But... on another occasion, there was six of us. Well, you see, we don't go out in as a bunch. We go out with about 5 minutes in between, you know. And we met and we went down into the village, which was practically deserted, like, very quiet. And we went into a bakery. And we had a little bit of a do there, you know. And then on the way back... We just turned round a corner and we bumped into a group of Jerrys. There was a kind of a guard going somewhere, and of course they encircled us. But I don't expect the rifles were loaded myself. That's all a lot of kidology. And because, they marched us back to onto the main road leading back to the camp. And there's a building there where the officers used to do jumping and riding and that, and it's called a Reich School. And we stood outside and the felt level come out, and he told two postmen, right, take them back to the camp, you see, and report them, see. Anyway, never asked us our name. So as we're going along this long road, cobble road, you know, across the railway line and sentry box and signal box and on. Well, we met a big bunch of prisoners of wars going back to the camp. They'd finished the job that they were on, I suppose, and they were going back to be redistributed to wherever they wanted labour. And we mixed amongst them. There was Russians, Belgians and French. And... of course, they were all carrying their little bits, odd pieces, like a big box or a sack or something, you know. So he said, oh, and Jerry always walked behind you, mixed with the other guards, see, having a natter. So two of them went, and it pitch black, you see. Jerry didn't know where you were, like, sort of style. They'd buzz off. And about 5 minutes afterwards, the next couple would go off. And the next 5 minutes, the next couple, you see. So we left them to go back on our own, you see. And, of course, as soon as you get to the guard at the gate, good night, good slaughter, and in, you see. And you wouldn't know the difference whether we'd been working in the laundry or where we'd been. And, of course, we hadn't been in bed very long, about an hour, when we could hear the Jerrys running round the camp, swearing like hell. Now, anybody that had had a candle lit, they'd have been dashing in to see whether it was one of us. But there's another, you see. Another.
Now, it was after these two affairs that you had the interview with the commandant, was it?
Yes, after the first one, you see, he interviewed me, you see. I don't know whether it was just a check or not or anything, but or whether I was... a sergeant in disguise, you know, an imposter, but because I looked very young then, you know, so I looked very young and pretty.
Did anything come of the interview? Did he say anything or do anything?
No, no, he just had a look at my pay book and asked the interpreter, like, I just answered yes, no, yes, no. And then there was, I had a picture of the old lady, you know, and that, and a picture of myself sitting at St. Paul. And there was a photographer in the camp at a place, and everybody had the photographs taken. Stood at the stool, they used to always stand at a stool or a table with his hand on it, and that was his line, and he was a very, very clever photographer. He even taken pictures of the football matches.
I've seen those. What nationality was he, this photographer?
German.
Was he an actual soldier?
Well, yes, he was really, but I suppose that the Germans allowed him, you see, because he was on a good thing.
And he would sell copies to the prisoners, would he, or would he give them away?
No, they'd pay for them.
Now, you mentioned when you went to the baker's and also the place where you bought some beer. Yeah. What were you using for money? Where did you get your money from?
Well, this Belgian had plenty of money. It'd be German money, turned into German money.
So you used his money?
Pfennigs and marks.
Was there any camp currency or any money?
No, it was just the same. German money.
But how did you get it? Was it always off this Belgian?
Oh, yes. That's the only money I got.
So you didn't have any supply at all of yourself?
No. No payment from England. One day, the commandant, he had us all on parade, and there was a German general come to inspect the camp. And, of course, we were a section on our own. A tiny bunch of us, you know, somewhere about 40 or so, 40 to 50. And stood there, and of course we're all dressed the same, you know, with one or two exceptions. There were six Australians, and we had collars and ties and real sporting dress, you know, and they looked very, very smart. And of course that was sent from Australia to them. And we're on this parade, and the commandant sent for the regimental sergeant major of the Australians and asked him to manoeuvre us about, do a bit of drill, you see, and he did so. You know, right turn, quick march, you know, mark time, about turn, and then left wheel, right wheel, and all over the place, you know. And then when he finished, like he said, stand at ease, and he went back and saluted the general. He said, any further, and the general said, I only wish I had an army as good as those men. So that was very complimentary. And we were always respected, I think. Always respected.
Did you? So you got on reasonably well with the Germans from the
Very, Sonar. Very, very, very well.
You actually seem to have had more food than they had, from the sound of it. Do you think that's true?
I do think it's true. Ours was a bit more tastier than theirs, even if it was bread and jam. Because their black bread, have you ever seen any of it? Eh? Like black treacle bread. And you couldn't swallow it when you chewed it. It's terrible stuff. It was sawdust knitted together.
Were you able to, the fact that you had better things, you know, and cigarettes and such, were you able to use them to bribe the guards?
We don't need to. We don't need to give them a cigarette, he thought he got the world.
Would you ask them to do anything for you?
No, we didn't need it. We didn't need it. Oh, no.
Was there any sort of internal organisation? I mean, you've mentioned that some of the jobs that prisoners did in the camp, like helping the office, helping the laundry, such like, you helped with the
cookhouse,
you helped with the parcels. Was there any actual organisation within the camp of the prisoners? Did you have things like an escape committee or things like that? Or did they have a British senior officer?
No, I told you that when you see on television and they're showing these camps and whatnot, and digging under the floorboard. We never had any cause to do anything like that, because the simple reason, if you got out of the camp and you were making an escape, you had to be a fluent speaker of German, and you'd have to have German clothes, and you would have a hell of a job to travel somewhere about 300 to 400 miles to the border without being detected. So you go, you probably get about halfway, and then somebody would say, "Ah, Englander," and back you'd come.
So there was no attempt to escape
at all.
There was no escape committee then?
No.
Was there any organisation of prisoners? I mean, who organised? You said there were forgeries. What were the forgeries for if they weren't for escape?
They'd be duplicating something. For instance, you know what it is, a saying, it's coming with the wind, you know. You see, well, we used to hear of things which would be heard in the administration sector, and then they'd come and tell you what was happening and what wasn't happening. For instance, when we used to be marching, Salto was more or less of a big village then. I do believe now that it's a big railway centre, because I've met several people that are stationed nearby at the present time. And they've told me that it's a big railway centre, where it was only a little village railway station then. And as we used to be going down the road, we'd perhaps be singing a song, such as, 1, 2, 3, the Kaiser's after me, 4, 5, 6, the enemy, somewhere in the right bloody fix, 8, 7, 8, 9, there's an Emmerich on the line. We'll be at Salto, in Salto, tonight. And as we used to pass a shop that had a big window, there used to be a map of his advance, and showing how good they'd done and whatnot. And then gradually, day by day, when the boot was on the other foot, you could see it coming back and coming back, till eventually they took the map out of the window. And we used to pass just one or two individual people that stand and stare at us and envy us, no doubt about that. And but there's a certain episode which I will not tell you, because I got caught out and I got away with it.
What
right?
was that?
Oh, no. I'm not telling you. I'll tell you.
Okay, what's next then?
When we were caught, we did no damage, really. We done good, really. And they took us to, me and my mate, to the right school. And it was going to do. So I told this here interpreter that come, and I said, "We've come here to see Lieutenant so-and-so. And he's been repatriated." And I said, "I want to see him, that's why we're out." See, which was a lie, you know, because they'd caught us. And all right, so he sent two postons with us to this hotel, a bit of an hotel that was there. Of course, pitch black, and any lights were well up the lobby, you know. And one sentry went, and out come this lieutenant. So sprung to attention, saluted him. He said, aye, what game's this?" So we explained to him. He said, "Good God, deliver us. What do you think it is?" I said, "It's just one of those things," I said. "We've just been happened to be caught." I said, "What do you want me to do?" And I said, "Well," I said, "before we go, tell these two blokes to take us back to the camp and emphasise it, because if they get us into that right school, we might get a bit of a thumping, and we don't want that." See? So he said, "Oh no," he said, "no." So anyhow, he went to the Boston and told them, with a wag of the finger, take them straight back to the camp. Well, of course, we'd got to pass the right school again, and we stood at the gate, and one of them went in, and they Feltmeb would come out and he played hell. Oh, he was raging mad. So any road, he couldn't do any other, you see. This lieutenant would give the order. So up the road we went, and they light a cigarette, give them a couple each, you see, and it was pitch black, and take the rifles off them and carry the rifles for them. You can hardly believe that, can't you? So it's true that every word I speak in that mic is very true. I said, I can take you to the places. And that is if this, I'll tell you where they were anyway. And any road, we sailing along the road and smuttering and smattering a bit of German and that, and we get to the camp, shook hands with them, send the guard letters in, good night, and we never heard any more about it. And they hadn't taken our names. See? I don't know whether they would be a little bit stricter if the boot was under the foot, they might have been.
I'm still a bit confused at why they had all these forgers, as to what they were forging for, if it wasn't for escape plans.
Well, if they saw something and they wanted a copy of it, they'd do it for themselves. So I'm only just mentioning the skill of them.
So it wasn't really for any purpose, it was just they'd copy things and...
No, for instance, that man engraving with a needle onto a coin, which is absolutely marvellous, it was. Marvellous.
Was there much scavenging going on to get bits and bobs to improve life?
No, I don't think so, because you couldn't really improve anything. You couldn't really improve anything.
Well, your friend got you sheets, I mean, that sort of thing.
Oh, well, of course, he used to bring his clean sheets and take the others back again. And Joseph Brassier, the quartermaster sergeant, he whenever anybody come into the camp and or the hospital, and he was an Englishman, Joseph gave him the full attention. He did everything for them. For instance, there was a lad from Mattlesfield, a lad named Wood. And Joseph told me that he'd had a leg off. Would I go and see him? So one evening I went with Joseph and had a good chat with this lad and said to him, you know where Waters Green is? Do I know where Waters Green is? I said, I think I do. I said, well, he used to knock about with a bird there. Sally Green. Get off, aye. So, any road, he was just skin and bones. You've seen a skeleton with skin on, if you haven't. But he was just going to... Any road, he got better. And later, when I was at home, I got a letter from the War Office to say that... which they generally did after anything like that, to get certain particulars. We believe that you helped while the prisoner of war by Quartermaster Sergeant Joseph Brassier, 10th Line Regiment, and that this individual did great work for any Englishman and whatnot. So I wrote back and I said, I can't praise him enough. I said, he's the finest gentleman I've ever met.
Why do you think he was so... Did he do this for the Belgians as well?
What, do what?
Help them.
He'd do it for anybody, but particularly when it was an Englishman, that was his object. What he thought about the British. That he'd look after them and do his best. And... anyway, I wrote back and I never got a reply about what he got, but I shouldn't wonder that he didn't get the DCM. He got a decoration.
Did you have any other friends in the camp that you made? Special friends, you know?
Yes, there was Lucien Vivlon. By the way, Joseph Brassier comes from a place called Abbeville-la-Neve. Abbeville-la-Neve. And I believe it's on the borders of Luxembourg. I believe so. That's what I've learnt this last few weeks. And sometime, if I ever get anywhere near there, I'm going to make my way to see whether there's any relations left or anything. Because through circumstances of me not having a good job or anything like that, and I had to fend for myself first, that I didn't correspond with him, although he wrote me, met for a minute, he was on congé, holiday, in Paris, and he was in different places, and he practically cried, really, that why didn't I write to him, you know. But at that time, I was too busy fending for myself, as you might say. And of course, later years, I regretted it. I regret it, but still, most of us have got something to regret about in our lives, and that is one of them. The other one, Lucien Juvelon, was a particular friend, because I used to borrow his football boots, although they were a bit bigger for me than for him, and he used to play rugby union for them. They generally played every Saturday, and we played every Sunday.
Well, that's brought us on to sport and recreation generally. So was there a lot of sport played at the camp?
Well, getting nearer to the end of the war, they had a sports day, and like the photographer showed you of the French, they did this display of on shoulders and that, you know, mounted on
to a pyramid.
A
pyramid.
Pyramid. And they were all dressed with sashes and in white and blueberries, and they looked really smart, and they were very, very clever. And then again, as regards amusement,
to the sport? You played
sports. We had sports. We had relay races and sprints, and of course there was only one good sprinter, and that was Barney Hudson from Durham way. And he could do evens then. I reckon he could do evens then, as a prisoner of war.
Was he a well-known sprinter?
Hmm?
Was he well-known before the war or something?
No, but he was well-known after the war.
And so there was... What about the football, you said? How was that organised in the camp?
Well, the referee was an Australian, and... they'd just get hold of the commandant and they'd get the little bit of equipment from England, the Red Cross, and any new balls, they'd get them from there. And you'd use your short underpants for white shorts and any old colour of a jersey for the coloured team, and use your singlet for the white team.
And yeah. How were you picked to play? Was it
We're somewhere about over 20-odd players, and we used to reverse the forward lines 1 week. Next week, we reversed the defence.
Was this just British who played football, or was it everybody?
No, there was a little Frenchman. He was a little good winger, and there was a big centre-half, a Belgian. He was a great player. And there's another couple.
But most of them were British.
Though. Oh, most of them were British. Yes,
there was
Huey Dixon. He could speak French pretty good. He was a brilliant player. He played for Darlington after the war for about 10 years, and captained them. I believe he had a little shop, greengrocery shop. And a friend of mine went to see him one day, and he mentioned me, and Huey said, Joe Fitz, wait a minute. He dashed upstairs and come back. He said, there's Joe Fitz on this photograph. I said, oh, aye, yes. Oh, yes, he said. And